Hi, everybody. My name is Mike Gibb. I run accountsrecovery.net, and I'm excited to be moderating today's webinar on understanding what is and what is not allowed when sending texts and emails. Text messaging and emails are two of the most bullish communication channels that companies in the credit collection industry would love to start using, and some have started using. But there is so much uncertainty and confusion about what is and what is not allowed that many companies opt to just stay on the sidelines. But that doesn't have to be the case. Today, we've got a pair of compliance experts with us to share their perspectives about how to approach communications via text messaging and emails. This webinar is being generously sponsored by LexisNexis Risk Solutions. You get the chance to hear more about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about accountsrecovery.net. Accountsrecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insight to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it's got to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. David Kaminsky is a partner at Carlson & Messer in Los Angeles and focuses his practice in the defense of the financial services industry. He is recognized for his work in defending against claims brought under consumer protection statutes, including the FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA, and all other federal state consumer protection laws. He regularly gives presentations at leading industry trade groups throughout the United States. David was the 2015 Attorney of the Year for ACA International and was the 2013 to 2015 chair of the Attorneys Division of the group. He also served on the ACA Regulatory Committee and the ACA Education Committee. W. Judd Peek is responsible for the creation, implementation, and continual oversight of the enterprise-wide compliance management system at the Frost Arnett Company. In this role, he ensures that the compliance program aligns with the overall corporate strategy, business plan, and code of ethics at Frost Arnett. Judd also oversees multiple compliance information, tracking, and monitoring systems. Prior to his role as Chief Compliance Officer, Judd spent 16 years as an attorney in private practice, specializing in employee relations issues. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them as the discussion is ongoing and when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please type it into your question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded and a recording will be made available later today on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I just want to ask everybody to take a minute and fill out the feedback survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your insights help me develop content. That's what to make sure that's what you're looking for, and find speakers like David and Judd who are the people you want to hear from. With that, let's move into the important part of today's event, and that's the discussion with Judd and David. Let's start from a high level, gentlemen. What regulations, laws, and legal rulings govern the sending of text messages and emails in collections?
Well, hello, everybody. This is David Kaminsky. Thank you so much. Mike Gibb, thank you so much, LexisNexis, for inviting us to the party here. We're glad to be a part of this. We've got so much content to talk to you about today. Hopefully we respond to most of your questions. I just want to give a quick caveat that this is a webinar, of course, and this is not legal advice. And the content that we're providing today, of course, is only for educational, general reference. We're trying to give you as much information as we can up to date. But for specific legal advice, of course, please consult your attorneys. And with that being said, I will answer or try to answer Mike's first question. So just starting from high level here, when we're looking at email and text messages, and I'll start with email first. With regard to email, you know, it's sort of, we are in uncharted waters in part. Yes, we have seen some CFPB, NPRN, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, We've seen what the CFPB is looking at or proposing. That is not law yet, it is not the rule yet. So when Judd and I speak to you today, we're really going to be speaking to you today about what is the current state of the law. What do you have to do today, or the things that you should be looking at towards these compliance issues? So although we may sort of circle around and touch upon the NPRM, we're really not going to do a deep dive because other seminars have done that, and that's not the seminar. But we're going to talk about the law today, because with regard to the notice of proposed rulemaking, that particular set of rulemaking, how that's going to look and what that law may be when it ultimately becomes a final rule, could be somewhere in late 2020, potentially at the earliest. As many of you know, right now, with regard to the proposed rulemaking, the CFPB has opened a comment period. I believe that comment period ends towards the end of August, approximately August 25th or thereabouts. And then the CFPB will thereafter potentially make a rule. And once they make that rule, they said that they are going to give 1 year for the implementation of that rule. But at that time, as you know, various groups or entities on either side of the coin can make various challenges to that rule and potentially seek a stay and obtain a stay from a federal appellate court with regard to the implementation of that rule. So even though a final rule could come out in about a year from now, a year and 3 months, 4 months from now, we don't know ultimately when the final rule will really be final. It's not over until the last person has sung in that opera. So to get into some issues here, with regard to email, again, email, we are in some kind of uncharted waters here. I know that a lot of people want to send emails to consumers. We're going to talk to you about email and what that looks like and how can you go about communicating with consumers via email. But right now, there's no specific laws that pertain to email that literally address email. But of course, the FDCPA governs communications with consumers. So you have to look at the rules pertaining to the FDCPA to see how we can communicate with consumers, and as to how we are using or what we may be sending with regard to an email, is that going to conflict with any of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act rules? Not only that, but you have to also take into consideration, as if that weren't enough, the various states' laws, such as the California Rosenthal Act, the Florida FCCPA, the Michigan Consumer Collections Act, and many other states that have, of course, their own consumer collection statutes and rules. So you have to look at that in context with, how am I doing this email? Am I allowed to do this email? Is it proper? Then, of course, you also have to look at the CAN-SPAM Act, but the CAN-SPAM Act, which does govern email, specifically really pertains to solicitations. And the majority of probably the persons who are on this phone call today and the entities and the companies are not sending out any kind of solicitations. It would be very strange to seek a payment recovery from a consumer at the same time trying to sell them a Kenmore washing machine. So since that's not happening, CAN-SPAM Act, that really pertains to solicitations and the proper way to construct an email. But when we're looking, of course, at the text message side, we're looking, of course, for text messages. Text messages are deemed to be a call, and calls via the calls that are made to a cell phone from an auto dialer, or when you're leaving pre-recorded messages, of course, is governed by the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Again, I'm not going to get into the solicitation rules pertaining to text messages because that's not really what we're talking about today. The majority of you on the phone are not doing solicitations with regard to the text. So with that, I'm going to see if Judd has any further comments in that regard.
Yeah, Mike and LexisNexis, thank you for letting me be part of this as well. I'm happy to be here and certainly enjoying doing this with David, one of the best thought leaders in this industry. I think that's a good kind of synopsis of the state of affairs for texting and emailing right now, David. I do think that this topic is timely right now because of the NPRM that's been released. So we've had various rules and regulations regarding texting and emailing consumers in place for some time, and case law interpretations of that. But that's going to probably be altered in some respect with the new debt collection rulemaking that's going to be effective at some point in the near future, as David explained. So I think giving that, in light of that and with that context, this is something we should be discussing. David, I don't know if you want to start with emails or texting or talk about the NPRM generally, but I almost think, you know, where the direction that the CFPB is going with their new rulemaking, texting and emailing consumers is going to become more prevalent. Whatever that final rule is going to be, it's given, the CFPB is going to give us the stamp of approval as long as we adhere to certain specifics. Texting consumers and emailing consumers is going to be allowed. We know that. I would put money on the fact that that's going to be maybe altered in some material aspects, but it's going to be in the final rule. So within the next 1 to 2 years, collection agencies are going to move in that direction, if you haven't already, of building up this capability. That's the method that consumers want to be reached more and more often. They don't want to receive paper snail mail letters. They don't want to receive actual phone calls, but they do want to have these multi-channel communications established where you can text and email a consumer and reach them that way. As right party contact rates continue to drop and there are initiatives to limit so-called robocalling from the FCC and from carriers, we need to look at other ways to communicate with consumers. Other ways to resolve their accounts prior to going to lawsuit. David, I think we might as well go ahead and start getting into the nitty gritty as far as text messaging. And as you mentioned, you know, the big 900-pound gorilla for this one is the TCPA, as text messages are considered calls or pre-recorded messages under the TCPA. That's going to be triggered. So the big issue for text messaging is always going to be, do you have consent? You know, either prior express consent from the consumer or, you know, to a certain extent, implied consent if they have reached out to you first or have provided their phone number as part of the in connection with the receipt of services that is the subject of the debt being collected upon.
Right.
I will say, you know, the FCC's interpretive rulings over the past few years, notwithstanding ACA, the lawsuit from a couple of years ago, they have expressly applied the TCPA to text messaging. So we know that that's going to be triggered. Their liability is there for text messaging. And the problem, well, not necessarily a problem, but the triggering factors for that is generally text messages are going to be an automated process. You're going to have some sort of platform that sends these out. And these meet the definition usually of pre-recorded because you have a template that goes out to consumer cell phones to receive this. These aren't customized text messages in most senses. So they're going to trigger the TCPA absent the existence of that consent. I do think, and we could talk about exactly how you obtain consent. I don't want to do too deep a dive into TCPA requirements, but I think it's important to know that that's there. And not only do you need to have that consent accumulated at some point, but you need to have you need to provide for the ability for consumers to opt out of text messaging communications. You know, we could say opt out because that's usually the vernacular of text messages or emails, but that's just another way of saying revocation. So they're revoking that consent to receive these text messages. One of the things that I think is important to keep in mind when you're talking about the revocation side of consent, it's important to make sure that a collection agency or any sender of text messages can define specific instructions as far as those opt-outs. So you can require a response, type the word stop to opt out instead of a lengthy diatribe like, I would appreciate if you discontinued sending me any more text messages, something like that. a lot of these, a lot of the systems that send and receive text messages, they're not monitored by a real-time person for every follow-up. So you need to have some AI in there, and most of the providers, third-party providers of this technology, they have that intelligence built in to where they are able to receive these specific opt-out messages and process that accordingly. I do think it's imperative, if you're looking at adding a text messaging service to your current bank of collection services, you need to look at a system that provides for that, that opt-out messaging process. So you can get that either through the system or through other means.
And that's a great point, Judd, because look, if the CFPB has its way and they're going to allow text messages, and text messages are going to be the current wave and the wave of the very near future with regard to multiple communications, and there are some companies right now that are texting certain information to consumers who wish to be texted. But what's very important, since the CFPB has already telegraphed that any notices or information provided to a consumer via a text, for example, must include a opt-out provision. And that makes great sense. And I'll tell you why, for several reasons. Number one, not only is it going to be with a wave of the future, but the MMA, the Mobile Marketing Association, with regard to text message, has said for years, look, if you want to try to minimize the risk of your liability in the context of sending out a text to someone, and in the event that you didn't have consent to text someone in the first place, they said having that opt-out or that ability to stop, and for a consumer to write that so they don't get any further texts from you, can potentially stop any further text to that particular consumer. And therefore, when a consumer is not bombarded with text after text after text that they didn't give consent to, but you think you had consent to communicate with them, that opt-out provision can really help mitigate potential risks. Because if you send one text to someone and they stop or they opt out, and your system properly captures that, and you're not communicating again, well, then the person really doesn't have that much to complain about and isn't running across the street to the attorney for a single text message that may have potentially violated the TCPA. So when you're thinking about your processes and developing a protocol for using text messages, then one of the things to think about so importantly is to have that opt-out provision. Because again, we've always advocated that when it comes to text messages, and even when it comes to get calls, when a consumer says, don't ever call me, stop calling me, and I'm disregarding for a moment what the laws may say throughout the country or what some federal circuit court of appeals may have ruled, just the better practice to minimize potential risks of liability or a $100,000 lawsuit that you may ultimately win, it's just to honor that revocation request. And what's going to help you so much is a stopped or opt-out provision. And it is going to be the wave of the future anyway.
Hey, David, let me ask you a question about that, because you know the revocation, the opt-out side of it is definitely important under the TCPA. But what about, I mean, would you recommend that agencies view an opt-out request or a revocation request as a cease and desist under the FDCPA as well?
You know, at this time, it should be looked at as cease and desist. Look, you want to look at all of the things that a consumer does as broadly as you can to bring it as best as you can within the confines of the FDCPA. And when someone says stop, that is almost the equivalent of don't communicate with me. And if someone's telling you not to communicate with them, the best course of action is to honor that. So an opt-out should be potentially looked at as a cease and desist, and not to communicate with that consumer, at least via text. Because if you're sending them a text and you're giving them an opt-out, It depends upon how your opt-out is worded. And remember, it's going to be the words in that opt-out that are critical and important to how you move into the future. But if that opt-out says to stop receiving any further texts, please hit stop here. That doesn't mean calls, okay? So, because that text was very specific, that opt-out was very specific. And if they respond to that and they say stop, it would be recommended, of course, to stop any further texting. With regard to calls, that may be a slightly different issue. And look, if you look at some of these rules and you look at them too broadly, well, then you're not going to be able to communicate with anyone, and you may misinterpret a communication from a consumer, and you may prevent a communication vehicle that you actually have consent or the right to engage in, and a consumer wasn't telling you, quote, not to ever communicate with them again. So look at the context of the scope of the opt-out that you've created and the language therein, because that will, quote, inform you how you move in the future.
Yeah, I think that's exactly a very important point. So the agency or the sender of the text message can control the language used in the opt-out and the manner in which it must be received. So it's important to limit that to just the text messages being sent. You don't want to have a drafting issue or a wording issue where it can be reasonably interpreted to be cease all communications or something like that. I don't want to have to defend
That's absolutely true. And of course, look, getting back to basics 101, with regard to text, you just want to make sure that you have the basics. The basics is consent. Do you have consent? Is it in your system? And is it in a form of consent that in the event there is a lawsuit saying, I never gave you consent to text me, that you have the information and the backup so that you have your evidence in order to defend yourself against an action? As judges say over and over, don't tell me about procedures and protocols that may or may not exist. Let me see what you actually have. What is the key evidence that you have to defend against this claim? Where is that recording? Where is that documentation? Where is that agreement? Where is the information that you obtained? So remember, having that consent is key to sending a text. And, you know, I know the question of the day that people are asking is, what is this consent going to look like when, and the ability to text someone in the context of the notice of proposed rulemaking from the CFPB? Well, we don't actually know. What we all believe is that the CFPB is not going to technically override the rules of consent with respect to the TCPA. So we don't know exactly how it's going to look like when it ultimately comes out. But so that's going to be mostly in a final rule that we ultimately get. But for right now, when we're talking about compliance, at this time, compliance is you must have consent to, quote, make a call. It's the same thing with a text, because a text is a call.
Excellent. I just want to pause the discussion briefly, if I can jump in here for a second. I don't want to disrupt the flow too much, because this has been a great conversation so far. But I just wanted to say a few words about the sponsor for today's webinar, and that's LexisNexis Risk Solutions. As many of you know, LexisNexis Risk Solutions supports the credit and collections industry through its comprehensive database of information on individuals and businesses. The information they compile comes from more than 10,000 sources and enables them to provide access to more than 280 million consumers and 48 million businesses. Their patented matching and linking technology called LexID assigns a unique and persistent identifier to each consumer. This unique identifier powerfully connects consumer information maintained in those disparate data sources, providing a very comprehensive view of each consumer. Additionally, LexisNexis has two products to help with your texting and emailing initiative. First is a product called Phone Ownership. This product provides information on the actual owner of the phone number you intend to text before you text to it. This will provide an extra layer of confidence that you were texting the intended consumer. Phone Ownership is currently available in batch. Second, they have recently updated their email search product. This allows you to confirm ownership of an email address, The email search is currently available on Accurate for Collections and will be coming this fall in batch. If you would like information on either of these products, please contact LexisNexis Risk Solutions at risk.lexisnexis.com or call them at 1-800-953-2877. Again, I just want to thank LexisNexis for sponsoring today's webinar. Really appreciate their continued support. With that, gentlemen, we've got a few questions that have come in on the topic of consent and opting out, and maybe we can tackle these quickly before we move on. First question, with the opt-out option, is it in real time, or does the consumer have to wait any number of calendar or business days? How does the opt-out work if the consumer's number was the sole means of achieving right party contact?
So generally, an opt-out does not have to be necessarily in real time. But I think it's important in most opt-outs, and this applies to email opting out as well, there has to be a reasonable time to be able to process that request. If the technology itself it's not instantaneous, then I can't imagine any court would hold an agency liable for anything that happened during the time that they were processing that request or that revocation. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think I would concur with that, Judd. I think that makes the most sense. There's got to be a reasonable period in which to implement it. And, you know, look, as we have seen in so much of the case law that has come out lately, that so many courts are at least suggesting or moving to a, quote, reasonableness factor with regard to several of these statutes, especially the TCPA. And why? Look, the TCPA is deemed to be a strict liability statute. That means that you're liable except for an out. The TCPA provides very few, if any, outs, as opposed to the FDCPA, where that also is a strict liability statute, but then you have the bona fide error defense, right? That is your potential out for potential liability for a majority of the FDCPA provisions, which have been deemed to be strict liability provisions. So hopefully that courts, CFPB, et cetera, will move more forward in that direction and looking for a good faith, you know, good faith conduct. Look, we're already seeing it with regard to the TCPA's reassigned number database. And I know all of you on this phone are saying, when the heck is that going to come out? But and when are we going to get final implementation on that? And I get it, because that could be a fantastic panacea, hopefully, to so many ridiculous claims that you get for calling wrong numbers under the TCPA, et cetera. And we're hoping that that will come out very shortly. But that's just my 2 cents on that.
Hey, Mike, there was another question that made me think of a broader question and kind of like to engage with David for a couple minutes on that. So while we're talking about the TCPA, you know, get consent, that's a proper consent. That's kind of a defense to any claims without having to get into the technology being used or anything like that. When we're dealing with text messages, generally, you know, it's considered to be a pre-recorded message, ergo TCPA trigger. David, have you, I'm not sure this option really exists in the industry, but have you thought about a TCPA workaround regarding manual text messages? And what I'm envisioning is, you know, collectors individually type out each text message, though there's no automation involved. And on top of that, there's this added element of human intervention, which in the dialing spectrum has been held to be a defense to a claim that there's an automated component to it. I'm not aware of any case law interpretations on this, but I'm wondering if you had thought or had any clients or this question has come up where text messaging for debt collection is done in a manual style, whether that's a complete defense.
Right. So let's talk about that just briefly. There are various decisions that have come out that have discussed certain text message platforms and said that because this text message platform required the person to upload the telephone numbers at issue and then to physically press a button or something to that effect in order to launch the specific text. Certain cases have said that is, quote, a sufficient element of human intervention, and therefore does not, the text message platform did not constitute an automatic telephone dialing system, a prohibited, quote, auto dialer, an ATDS. So there are some decisions that have discussed that. As many of you know on this phone, you know that there's various decisions that have come out as of late that were certain jurisdictions, federal circuit courts have ruled that unless you're using a random and sequential number generator, you don't have an auto dialing system. And that's on the tech side. That's also on the calling side. So those decisions are very favorable too. But look, you know, you have to look and try to develop a policy, especially when we're going to get into communications with consumers and when hopefully the CFPB opens the floodgate for, you know, texting, et cetera, and gives us some guidance as to how they want us to do that. It's best to also, I believe, look for a way to communicate if you don't have consent. Look for a way to communicate that you are not using an automated telephone dialing system, because if you're not using an automated telephone dialing system and you're sending a text message, then you potentially don't have TCPA liability, even if you don't have consent. So if you don't have consent, you shouldn't be using an auto dialer. If you're using an auto dialer, you want to make sure that you have that consent.
Yeah, and I oppose that topic with the understanding that something like that, the more manual you get, the harder, less practical it is to implement at scale. But certainly on a one-off or a limited scale purpose, I think that might be an option that agencies could look into.
And there are certain platforms out there that discuss the fact that they are, quote, TCPA compliant. I'm not saying that they are, but there are some that advertise that they are, and there are many that you can certainly look into in that regard.
You know, David, we've talked about the TCPA for text messaging for a few minutes now, but I think it's important to also hit on the FDCPA issues. And one of the challenges is this risk of third-party disclosure with text messaging. And I'm not talking about a reassigned number issue. I'm talking about if a consumer has their cell phone out on a table, and more often than not, if they receive a text message, it pops up on a locked screen. So anybody that is looking at the phone can view the content of that text message. That's something that you need to be cognizant of, specifically how your texting, how that comes across on a variety of different carriers, different types of cell phones that receive this, what's going to be displayed potentially unwittingly to a third party?
You know, that's an interesting issue, and that could be a 40-minute discussion just in the content of the type of message that you want to send. But let me back it up and make it, let's talk more practically here for a minute, right? Because the CFPB is going to say you can text in certain situations. There have been various courts decisions from various federal courts throughout the country that have discussed the issue of a third-party disclosure in the context of an FDCPA claim, because a text message may have been made with consent, but it disclosed third-party information, and Aunt Sally saw my cell phone there and saw that I had a debt and ran screaming out of the house. Well, so when we're talking about that, most courts have said, look, we can take this to the extreme and get crazy about this, but the bottom line is that a cell phone is usually personal to a person. It is with the person. It stays with the person. It goes with the person. Usually people don't have their cell phone message out for the world to see, because most consumers use their cell phone for all of their personal needs, and therefore it's considered a personal device. So if someone leaves their cell phone out, a text message hit, and for the 10 seconds that the phone maybe has a flash that you received a text message from someone, you know, I think that the third party disclosure risk right at this time is extremely, extremely low from a from a liability standpoint, also just from a technology standpoint, most of the times when text messages do hit your cell phone, and even if your cell phone is out on a desk or something, usually, you know, there's such cryptic information that's given on the, let's say, on the when an email, when a text message flashes, you don't get the whole text message there. Sometimes you don't even know who the sender is. At least that's the way my cell phone works. You know, I can see that I got a text message hit, but I don't know who it's from. So I'm thinking that the risk is going to be pretty low.
And that might be the good thing about something like that or that type of claim is I think there would be challenges to making it class actionable because it's going to be an individualized assessment. What is actually visible on your cell phone versus a different consumer's? Depending on where people's risk. Sorry, go ahead, David. Yeah.
No, I think you're right. That's very true, Judd. And Mike and Judd, I think it's a good time since we're talking about text messages to certainly talk about the FDCPA's 1692G notice, or what we have also talked about is an initial collection communication. And in that first written communication to the consumer, which usually contains the G notice, what's your thought, Judd, about that in the context of doing it via text?
Well, I think it's very risky. If I were to implement a text messaging strategy from start, I would exclude your initial validation communication from that strategy. Just without having really robust consent in place beforehand, if you're just the type of agency where an account gets placed with you and it's up to you to figure out how to communicate with the consumer and get paid, it's going to be really something difficult to do. Where we have drawn the line as far as, you know, acceptable best practices, in my head, those statutorily required notices, so your G notice, dispute resolution letters, sometimes credit reporting notices, those should be exempt from an emailing or a texting platform for the most part. And it's all those other communications that I think would be ripe and appropriate for these multi-channel communications.
I think I would agree with that. I think it's too difficult right at this point and this time before we get additional clarity to send the 1692G notice via text. How do you do it? How do you get that in one text? Even if you have a link or a redirect, which provides the majority information that you can't give in a 160 character text, is that going to be deemed a second communication by various courts throughout the country right now as we sit before we get our final rules from the CFPB? And what is the CFPB going to allow with that? We have some kind of indication because we have a sample model notice. Is that going to be allowed via text as well? We're going to see that shortly, but there's also some issues because on that sample notice, there's also a perforation. Remains a lot to be seen, but right now the best, I think, recommendation for best practices right now is not to consider sending a 1692G notice under the FDCPA via text.
Yeah,
it's just not manageable right now.
Yeah, the challenge is proving that the consumer actually received it, and you know if you're emailing or texting that, that's a difficult thing to prove. You don't get the presumption of receipt at, like you do through the mailbox rule with a paper letter that you send or anything like that. And if you're assuming that there's receipt and you communicate afterwards and you can't prove that the consumer ever got it, then you've got an overshadowing claim.
Very, very good point. And Judd, with that, I think we should probably segue to emails and the FDCPA because I know that's on everybody's mind. Look, everybody's so confused with, we've got the FDCPA rules, we've got the CFPB rules that, you know, may come out in the future. We've got the Lavallee case, which is one of the lead cases that has dealt with this issue on emails. And where do we stand today and what can and we cannot do? And it's a great question, and I think it's one that we should tackle here for our audience. Judd and I will just give my initial thoughts, and of course want you to pipe in and give me your thoughts as well as Mike Gibb. So emailing today, look, the FDCPA talks about communications with consumers and how you can do it, right? And the big issue is the 1692G notice. But before you even get there, the question is, do you have an email from the consumer, and is it from consumer? Some entities have discussed scrubbing certain databases to obtain emails, to get emails of consumers. That, to me, is just a very, very risky proposition. There is no law that says that you must obtain consent before you can email a consumer. But if you don't have consent for the consumer, and if you're not getting the email from the horse's mouth, from the consumer, then how do you know that email address really pertains to that consumer? And even then, you may have issues. So I think step one is, when you're talking about emailing to a consumer, number one, do you have consent? Meaning they've given you their email address and given it to you in a connection with a communications. Look, with regard to certain applications that a consumer may make, it's got a spot for the email address, and it says, if you would like us to communicate with you in email, please give us your email address here and check this box. So you may be able to get that kind of email consent, but of course it's also, do you have that consent? Do you have the information? What is the source of the email address that you're getting? So that's very, very, very important. Was email a communication that was technically a negotiated term in a contract between the parties? Terms and conditions pertaining to a credit card contract that says, we may contact you at the email address you provide to discuss with you all of the following. And so you may have, quote, general consent to use that email. But certainly if someone voluntarily provides you their email address, says, please contact me at this email address, only contact me via email with regard to any communications you may wish to have with me. Those type of things are the type of things that you're going to look for when communicating and thinking about communicating with a consumer via email, because you want to make sure you have that right email address. Look, the one thing is in an email, you can fit a G notice in an email, right? And you can put most of your information within that email. I want to just mention briefly, and I want to sort of jump into that Lavallee case that I had mentioned before, because it's one of the few cases that's out there that actually addresses the providing of a 1692 FDCPA validation notice via an email. And in this case, very quickly, the court said that if you're sending a validation notice via email, but you're requiring the consumer to click on a link to open a secure package to then have them implement information and put security words to go through 4 to 5, 6, 7 steps in order to get to that email, that is not the sending of a validation notice under the FDCPA as the law exists today. Yes, the CFPB is moving to a more practical way. They're coming finally into the 90s here, and they're trying to open the floodgates. And you saw from the proposed the notice of proposed rulemaking that they're going to allow an email, and that is going to happen. And that's a great thing, because I think industry is looking at the CFPB new rules as a semi breath of fresh air. We're looking at them with a glass half full. Instead of the glass half empty, that this is an opportunity to allow waves of communication and methods of communication that not only that consumer wants, but it's an easier way to communicate them, and a way that a consumer may respond more readily and aptly, as opposed to, quote, the leaving of a phone message on a consumer's voicemail that they may never ever respond to, as so many of you have seen through your analytics of that issue. But the Lavallee case said, hey, you know, the question is, you just can't take a email, put all these redirects and all these links, and have that be your G notice and open it up. Now, this is only one court in the Southern District of Indiana, one federal district court. It is not the law of the land, nor is it controlling law within that jurisdiction, but it sort of gives us a guide. Why? because that case now is being appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal. The hearing has not taken place yet. The ACA International and the CFPB filed amicus briefs. What's interesting is that the CFPB filed an amicus brief saying that in order to send an email regarding the FDCPA validation notice in the first place, you have to first obtain e-sign permission. That's e-sign permission, and that is the Electronic Signatures and Global Communications Act. And before you can ever send that, you got to obtain that. But however, we've seen from the CFPB's notice of proposed rulemaking that the CFPB is really coming at this from a totally different direction. And I wouldn't be surprised if they haven't already, and I haven't checked the docket lately, if the CFPB ultimately pulls its amicus brief in that case, because I think that they're backing away from this whole e-sign requirement that you would have to first obtain that e-sign signature, the electronic signature permission from a consumer before you could ever send them an email. That's crazy, and that really contradicts what the CFPB is trying to do, which is open up the communications gap via email.
Yeah, Dave, I agree. I would not be surprised if the CFPB retracts it as well, because if you look at the NPRM, they're addressing that in a different way, requiring the sending of advance notice no more than 30 days before engaging in email or text messaging communications. I think in the CFPB's mindset, that's going to accomplish the same thing without having to rely upon the necessarily adherence to the eSign Act.
That's right. But if you're looking at an email right now, you should treat the email as if it, in a sense, were a letter, meaning that everything that you would put in your first collection letter should be in that email without the trappings of redirects and links and security messages. When you're looking at FDCPA compliance with regard to email and, you know, being able to email consumers, you still have to provide that meaningful identity of the debt collector's name. You want to also seek to, quote, avoid unauthorized disclosures. So you have to look at what you are putting in your from line, in your subject line, in your to line. You know, looking at an email again, you need to treat it basically as a writing. And of course, right now, as the law exists, we still have to comply with those time, place, and manner considerations that we have to consider with regard to the FDCPA. One person I was talking with recently said, oh boy, you can send an email out at any time because the consumer can receive that at any time in the world. That's not how I'm looking at it. With regard to the sending of an email is at the time that you send it. And that is a communication to a consumer at the time you send that email. So if you hit that email at 12 p.m., you may be violating not only the time and manner restrictions of the FDCPA, but also of various state laws that either have their own state laws on this issue or incorporate that a violation of the FDCPA constitutes a violation of that state's debt collection law. So you have to look at all the FDCPA rules when you're doing an email. Very, very important. And, you know, you have to look at all the disclosures, all of the state disclosure requirements that you need. But then there's the question of receipt of an email. And as the Lavallee court said, which is a very important issue, the Lavallee court said, hey, with regard to email, yes, this person actually received the email, obviously, because they're suing on it. So they got it, and they got it roughly at the same time that it was sent. But the problem is, how do you know that an email is actually received by the consumer? Well, number one, having their email address is absolutely critical. And that's so important. So having their email address and the consent from the consumer at a specific email address is critical. But the Lavallee case said, you know, an email is really not the same thing as a letter. And sorry, the FDCPA deals with a letter, and we get it that this is 2017, but the FDCPA has not been updated to address receipt of communications by letters. And as the lovely court said, there are states throughout the country that have laws that regulate the sending of a letter and what that means, and mailbox rules that said if you mail a letter, it is deemed to be received in X amount of days, subject to that being rebutted by the person to whom that particular letter was said. Those same laws don't provide the same rules with regard to emails, but I'll just leave you with this because we can get into an email discussion for literally 40 minutes with regard to all the issues that you have to think about. And of course, Mike Gibb and I and Judd have been talking about just giving a seminar only on email communications and the FDCPA and other related laws. But there's also something to think about. There are certain platforms out there that say they can tell you with almost a 90 to 100% accuracy whether or not that email was properly sent and received and opened by the consumer. There are very, very sophisticated platforms that exist today. So that's something that you should look at when you're thinking about doing the email, because one thing that you'd want to prove, because you don't have the benefit of the mailbox rule, is that we sent this email, it absolutely was received, here's the data and documentation to back this up, and this documentation by this expert is deemed to be accurate within a certain period. But then again, when you are sending an email and you are sending it in a certain time period, if you don't get a response from a consumer when you're sending an email that requires a response, then you may want to think about then following that up with a written communication as set forth in the FDCPA. So there's so many things to think about, you know, emails, but you can do it. We've just given you some highlights and some basics as to what you need to think about. Yes, I know what you're saying. You're saying, my gosh, in about maybe a year, year and a half or so, I'm going to be able to send emails and my G notice probably in the format that the CFPB subscribes in the proposed sample rule, I'm going to probably be able to send that by email and I'm going to be okay. And I'm going to have a bona fide error defense as long as I comply with those CFPB rules. We just don't have that right now. So if you're having issues or concerned about sending your initial G notice by email, then maybe you stop that, but you think about subsequent communications that you may want to have with the consumer doing that by email, because then you are not tied to the receipt issues, the mailbox rule issues, and the other communication pitfalls that do come up with sending a G notice via email. But there are some entities that say that this can be done and there are methods out there. So there's avenues to proceed in this regard. Judd, any further comments on that issue?
Yeah, so as I'm hearing it, I think from the agency standpoint, what you need to look at if you're thinking about emailing consumers is two main issues. Making sure it's effective, meaning they're actually receiving it and they're actually viewing it. So, you know, if it's getting caught in spam filters, they're not actually receiving it, they're not actually reviewing it. Certainly for a G notice, you can't just rely on the sent rule. And then the third-party disclosure issue, making sure that it hasn't been seen by somebody else. So if you're talking about an email address, make sure it's not a shared one or an email account that somebody else has access to. That's one of the reasons why the CFPB's, the NPRM, has excluded the ability to send to an employer email address, because there's no expectation of privacy for those. The only personal email addresses will be allowed. And also look at the subject line, the body of the email itself. Are you giving information as to a debt on that can be seen by a third party? The meat, I would recommend the meat of the email communication be kept either in a protected attachment or a link where the consumer has to log in and somehow confirm their identity before they're able to read and receive the communication itself. I think those are the things you need to really look at.
Right. Sorry, David. I would know, right. No. Judd, you're absolutely right. I would just be cautious about that when you're considering doing a G notice via an email and using a redirect or a link. although it does have the security that you'd want to do, so you're potentially avoiding a third-party disclosure, I think that you need to at least look at the Lavallee case as some type of guidance for how a court could potentially rule with regard to doing it in that manner. So,
right. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah, I was speaking of the non-gene notice communications. That if right. you're sending the validation,
and I thought you were the subsequent communications. Right.
One other thing I think is it's kind of a tangential issue, but if you're doing medical debt, you make sure that texting and emailing, if you're including PHI for medical accounts, you're going to have to adhere to HIPAA and high-tech privacy rules regarding the encryption of that data through the whatever channel you're sending it. So that's something else to be aware of.
Very good points.
Well, we've only got a few minutes left. We do have a few questions that were submitted earlier by interested parties. We do have a few questions left in the queue that we did not get to. And I don't want to go over too long because David and Judd have done an awesome job for 57 minutes so far, and I don't want to take up too much more of their time. But maybe if there's a couple of things we could sort of rapid fire through in the last few minutes, just to sort of round out the discussion, that might be the best way to finish off here. One potential question that came in is it necessary to send text and email by time zone and the limitations to the number we can send per day per week? Does anyone want to tackle that one quickly?
Sure. This is David Kaminsky. Sure. As we mentioned earlier, if you're sending a text, if you're sending an email, those are going to be deemed communications to a consumer, especially under the FTCPA. So when you're communicating with them, make sure that you're complying with the time and manner restrictions, just as what you would do if you were calling someone on the phone. Because just because someone could answer a text at any time they want, because it's there for them to see, doesn't mean that text message didn't hit. In fact, there was a lawsuit not too long ago where the plaintiff said, I gave permission to text and they did text me, but they were texting me at 1 a.m. in the morning and that thing was pinging so bad it disturbed me. But even if it didn't disturb the person may still be able to potentially have an FDCPA claim for violating the time manner restriction. So you really want to be careful with that with regard to email and text messages. Just treat them as communications under the FDCPA, and I think you should follow those rules and look at how many of those that you could send a week. Look at what the state laws say with respect to that. You know, Massachusetts, et cetera, right now they have, you know, such draconian communication rules, how many text messages, how many communications you can have per week with a consumer. So you want to follow those same rules with regard to text, with regard to email.
One thing that makes me think of, David, just when we're talking about the NPRM, you know, there's an allowance for limited content messages that those do not qualify as communications under the FDCPA. That does not apply to email and text messages. So there's no provision for that limited content message to be sent via email or text. Any email will be a communication, right?
And even though the CFPB has suggested that there may be seven communications per week, per account, per consumer, so you're thinking, okay, can I contact a consumer 70 times per week if I have 10 accounts with them and I need to communicate with them on 10 different accounts? Well, as the way the rule is drafted right now, it sort of looks that way. But of course, we have to look at how the currently, as we sit here today, and without the benefit of those rules being a final rule, we have to look at the harassment provisions of the FTCPA. We have to look at the estate communication restrictions on communicating with consumers as well when you're sending text and email.
Excellent. Well, we've reached the top of the hour, but before I let David and Judd go, what I'd like them to do is maybe just take, you know, a brief 30 to 45 seconds or so each, and summarize a key thought or a key takeaway, or you know, any sort of parting words of wisdom that they wanted to share with the audience. I think they've done an awesome job. There's been a ton of information, but maybe just a one last sort of final takeaway, if you don't mind. Jeb, would you mind going first?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And it's been a pleasure to be part of this today. Thank you for letting me be in on it. I think the best thing, or the thing that I want to impart on agencies that are looking to start texting or emailing, and they're really trying to figure it out, slow walk into it, honestly. There's no, even though the CFPB is going to give their stamp of approval for this technology for consumer communications, it's something I would recommend easing into, because you want to make sure that you've got the processes, the policies, the procedures in place to avail yourself of those bona fide defenses, bona fide error defenses. So the NPRM, the final rule, is probably going to have a bona fide error defense for both texting and for email communications if they've unwittingly been sent to a third party, or it violates the time, place, or manner, or any convenient time restrictions, anything like that. You want to make sure that you're building it the right way from the floor up. And I think that, you know, one of the best ways to do that is to take your time. Don't roll it out wide scale on the first go around, and get a good person on the outside, an advisor, either legal counsel or a good vendor that can really walk through it and has asked these questions before and has really figured it out.
Judd, that's great.
Much.
I could.
Judd, go ahead, David.
And sure, Mike, thank you. Judd, I would literally echo those exact statements. You know, walk before you run. Look, there are ways to do certain of the things that we are talking about. There are some things that you can't do, and I think we've discussed that here. But there are ways to do something. There may be a way to send out an email with regard to a 1692 validation notice. There are entities and certain platforms and companies that are working with various entities that are doing that right now as we speak. I would look at that. I would consult with them. See if that works with respect to your particular model for your company, because every single company is different and one size does not fit all. So look to see how your company operates. What's the best for your company? What is the best communication method for your company? Run the analytics first within your company to say, how are we getting return communications from consumers the best? Is it coming from our voicemails? Is it coming from our pre-recorded messages? Is it coming from the emails that we have sent and tested to consumers in the past? Look at the ways that you have been communicating. Look what works from your company. And certainly, please consult outside help with this. Consult your chief compliance officer. Certainly, consult your outside counsel to get the right barometer to find out what works for you within the confines of the law. And thank you so much again. Really an honor and pleasure to work with Mike Gibb and Lexis and Judd Peek. A real honor to work with you. So thank you so much.
The honor, I believe, is all ours, David and Judd, for being able to listen to you guys for the past hour. I really appreciate you taking the time to provide such insightful and comprehensive information to our audience. Again, I also want to thank LexisNexis Risk Solutions one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. For more information about the company and its offerings, please go to risk.lexisnexis.com. I really appreciate that. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. I'm sorry if we didn't get to your questions. We just ran out of time. But on the other hand, I will take these questions and hopefully turn them into more webinars in the future. So stay tuned for that. One final reminder to please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey for today's webinar to help identify topics and speakers that will be of the best use to you. A recording of this event will be posted later today to accountsrecovery.net, and please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Please be sure to enjoy the rest of your day. David, Judd, thank you so much on behalf of everybody. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.